Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path 2, Part 14.
Wednesday, August 11th, A Trackless Path 2, Evening Session. I'm getting this down. There's one question was posed to me a couple of days ago, which I have not responded to, but I should, since the subject matter has been mentioned any time without any other reference, and that is sky gazing. In the Jewel Ornaments of Liberation, in the discussion of the perfection of wisdom, there's a quotation from a teacher, I think. I don't think it's from one of the sutras. Which says, in reference to the perfection of wisdom, look at the sky, learn what that means. A little enigmatic. The Dzogchen tradition, there's a... there are a number of teachings in various traditions on sky gazing, but the one that I've been exposed to and feels most complete is one from the Dzogchen tradition, in which there are three skies, just to make it complicated. The practice consists of sitting or lying down in a location where ideally all you have is sky in front of you. There were caves that were carefully constructed in Tibet so that when you, on the sides of mountains, so that when you sat in them, sat in a certain position, you saw nothing but sky. There was no other reference point whatsoever. So, not always that easy to arrange, but here we have, particularly in the morning, generally speaking, we have very clear skies. And we've been very fortunate this retreat that way. Other retreats, it hasn't been so obliging. So it's not too hard to find a place where you can sit and have very, very little in your peripheral vision. And then you quite literally look at the sky. Now, as Talopa says, when you look at space, seeing stops. When you look at mind, thinking stops. It is important to look at the sky, or to put it slightly differently, to look into the sky. So you're actually looking. You're not just letting your eyes go into a soft thing because there's not a soft focus because there's nothing to look at. When you do that, you actually become passive and probably move in a somewhat dull direction. The looking is active. And the first sky is what we ordinarily call sky. It's infinite expanse of blue in front of us. And you look at that, or into it, And just because of the way the eyes are constructed, there will be pixelation and variation in shades and so forth. You know, pay no attention to all of that. That's just stuff. And look. If the looking is active, you'll find a couple of things. In the beginning, you probably won't be able to do it for very long because the intensity of the clarity is like a little overwhelming. And you just find like you're sort of short-circuiting. But as you do it again and again, you'll build up more capacity. And as you look without active looking, you find it's actually difficult to hold any train of thought. I should mention one other thing on the practical side. At this altitude, wear sunblock. If you're wearing sunglasses, the best kind of sunglasses are the ones that, you know, like these cool skiers wear that just cover everything so you don't have any frames or anything like that. But in the earlier morning, in the shade, if you're lying in the shade looking out, you actually don't need sunglasses. But if you're doing this later in the day, probably you do. And of course, you don't look in the direction of the sun. It's bad business. There are practices which have you do looking in the direction of the sun, but they're quite different. One of the reasons I like, when I first checked out Mandala Center, which was several years ago, I noticed that it was on the north face of this mountain, which meant it was, made it really good for sun gazing, because it was facing away from the sun. Or sky gazing, rather, not sun gazing. So there's that active looking in the sky. And as you engage that and increase your capacity to hold that gaze into the sky, very hard to hold together the ordinary train of thinking and just keeps disintegrating. Which, of course, is part of the purpose of this practice. And you find you're beginning to experience calm abiding, shamatha, just resting. But it's got a little more juice than shamatha and meditation because of your opening to the sky, and there's just all that energy of the light coming in. It fills your whole mind and being with light and energy. So it's quite a powerful practice. And as your mind or the thinking process crumbles and disintegrates, and doesn't do this immediately, so don't get your hopes up. You find well, if you speak technically, the sensory consciousnesses become less and less dominant in one's experience. That's the five associated with the senses, except the one for seeing, of course. And the mental consciousness, which is associated with thought. And you'll find that the seventh consciousness, the emotional mind, which is what I like to call it, also subsides. And you'll find yourself resting without much sense of I. And basically what's happening here is that you're experiencing basis of everything consciousness. Sanskrit term for that is alaya vijnana. I can spell it if you really want, but the basis of everything consciousness. Now, in basis of everything consciousness, there is no explicit sense of I or other. But it is not beyond duality. There's no explicit sense of I or other, and as Dajim Rinpoche explained to me, it's clear, empty, and ineffective. And for those who want the Tibetan for ineffective, it's Lungma Ten. Do you approve? What? The microphone. Go ahead. You're allowed to speak. You just have to make sure it's recorded.
It's interesting that that's Lungma Ten because that's the dullness in meditation, too.
Sure, yeah. It's tongues, as Dajim Rinpoche would say, Tongsa Lungma Ten. Lungma Ten is often translated as neutral, but it has this, there's no juice to it. That's the idea. Now, there's a little bit of an aside, but it's, particularly in reference to Carolyn's comment, it's important. There are countless meditators over the centuries who mistake resting in alaya vijnana for enlightenment. It's not, basically. Again, Dajim Rinpoche explained this. This is when he was giving us the Mahamudra instruction. It's empty, clear, and ineffective, no juice, however you want to describe that to yourselves. It's like a block of ice. And alaya vijnana to Buddha mind is like ice to water. That is, ice is clear, you can see right through it, you don't know it's there, and it can't do anything because it's a block of ice. And when you rest in it, bringing active attention into it, basically the ice melts. And then you have empty, clear, unrestricted experience. And the Lungma Ten becomes, or the ineffective becomes unrestricted. So it becomes very, very alive. Juice. Sonia, microphone, please.
Yeah, you made reference to Buddha mind. And with the refuge prayer, it's echoing a lot that's been coming up in practice. But when I do the sky gazing, the lines remind me of the experiences of the sky gazing.
The refuge prayer lines.
Yeah, nothing outside or inside to free me. Experience and awareness are not too.
Yeah.
But so you just made reference to Buddha and the quality of that. I'm not making the leap, but the quality of that, how that relates to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, it's like, it's almost there, but I'm not making, it's a quality, it's not.
Let's pick this up when I finish
okay.
Talking about sky gazing, okay. Then we'll pick that one up.
Okay.
And I don't know that I'll be able to field it, but I'll try. You can hit it again, maybe it'll hit it over the fence, then I don't have to worry about it. So, that's the second sky, which is basically the mind at rest, was deeply at rest, it's alaya vijnana, or basis of everything consciousness. So you'll have an internal experience of empty clarity. And there's no explicit sense of I, as I said in that, but as soon as there's any movement, the duality is there. I mean, if you really want to get technical, you get into the immediate consciousness, and as things pop into immediate consciousness, then they go either into the emotional mind and become and are experienced as a sense of I, or they go into one of the sensory consciousnesses and are experienced as an object. That's your technical explanation. Seven or any of the six. Paul.
I think I missed the difference between the effective and ineffective way of doing it.
I'm coming to that.
Oh.
It's not the difference between the effective or ineffective way of doing it. These are stages. First, you look in the sky. And that's the sky you're looking into. And as the mind settles, then you become aware of this, quotation marks, internal sky, which, and I'm describing what that is in really technical Buddhist vocabulary because I have to earn my money somehow. I just can't crack jokes and tell stories all the time. At least I think I can't crack. So, and you'll find that you start looking into that internal sky. Now, your eyes will still be looking into the external sky, but there's going to be a shift in inside, and now you're going to be staring into that clear, empty space, which is mind. And as you do this, and please don't think this is like you sit down and this unfolds in an hour and a half. Then what in Dzogchen is called Rigpa, translation awareness or direct awareness, you begin to experience that. I don't want to say it arises. It's. I don't even know how to put it into English, really. I don't want to say you become aware that it's there, because there isn't any you there. Let's just say it's there. That works for me. And so what was empty, clear, and ineffective now is experienced as empty, clear, and dynamic. That's the third sky. Now, you don't make these things happen. They unfold in practice. So you can't lie back and say, I'm going to look at the third sky. It doesn't work that way. You laugh. I will bet when you do this, you actually have that thought when you do it. Okay. Sophie, did you have a question?
I was just curious. I found the clear nights I was staring at the night sky, and I know, you know, the Milky Way and the stars are there. Except for a falling star, I felt very absorbed into it.
Yeah, you can do this with the night sky too.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a Zen teacher who lives in Northern California. Never met her in person, actually. She just calls me up occasionally. And I suggested, she called me up about her practice at one point, and I suggested that she lives right out in the woods, so fairly isolated, so she can do what she wants. And I suggested that she do some... I think she'd sustained some kind of injury or something, so she couldn't do her normal sitting. I said, why don't you just do this and, you know, get your lawn chair and just lie out in the day, in the evenings, and look at the sky. And she found it really, really helpful. Why? Because in Zen practice, what do? So she just went... And that was... And that's perfect. And I was fine for the summer, and then around October or so, she called me up. I'm not going to be able to do this over the winter, and it's pretty good. What do I do now? I said, doesn't work. you need that. So, just a sec, Sophie. And so I said, remember the feeling. There's a, when you're looking in the sky, there's a certain body sensation. When you're looking into the inner sky, there's a body sensation. When there's Rigpa is there, or this direct awareness is there, there's a body sensation. You remember that body sensation and rest right there. And so she found that just worked perfectly for her. You just continue the practice without any problem. Sophie.
Well, just a follow-up to that, the two nights that I did it, because it was just so magnificent, I had so much energy, I couldn't go to sleep till like 2 or 2.30 in the morning.
Duh.
I'm looking at it, and I didn't realize until I went in and I lay there, I was just like...
Yeah, it's a highly energizing practice. By the way, official announcement, it's August 11th, it's the Perseid meteor shower tonight. It's usually around 2 or so, but it's pretty good fireworks. Michael, you had a question.
So this may be apples and oranges, but I was taught sky gazing that sounded really different, that had very definite postures that weren't sitting or lying, and also had what sounds like a different goal, although it was... it involved Rigpa, but it was also looking at, I don't remember the exact language, but in movement or I might have been called impurities in your basic energy that, and when those movements ceased, that was a sign of some kind of stability. That doesn't sound like the same practice.
You're not talking about Tugal?
Yes.
Oh, that's totally different practice.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
I was thinking,
no,
this is not where I'm...
No, that's not sky gazing. No satisfactory translation, some people call it taking the leap or whatever. But it's Tugal, it's a Dzogchen practice, and it's totally different from this.
Okay.
Yeah. So... that was from Kenpo Tsultrum?
And some other people.
Yeah, right, okay, yeah. Now, that's a very different practice. So, no, I mean, in the Dzogchen scheme, you would say that the sky gazing I'm talking about is more in the Trekcha area. Yeah.
Although it was powerful in the same kind of way, where you would lose your...
Oh, it's a very, very subtle. It's a very subtle practice, which and in that practice you're assuming there are three postures and a couple of gazes, and the purpose of those postures is to put stress in the body, in a certain way so that it brings out a certain energy. There's an energy transformation, and it only works if your body is actually can assume those postures. There are lots of people who that it puts way too much stress on the body, and there's just no possibility of resting. So it's a very, very refined practice. Yep. Larry.
If you don't have any clear sky, or the sky is hard on one's eyes, is a blank wall pretty much the same thing, do you think?
No.
I thought you'd say that.
I mean, Soto Zen worked with blank walls, and they find it very effective, but it's not the same thing at all, you know.
And it's not the same thing with a cloudy sky.
Not really, because you don't have the same light pouring into you. I mean, you can develop and will develop a certain equanimity, and when you know how to do this sky gazing, you can probably use a clear sky. But you know, this is a product of India.
You mean
to
use a cloudy sky?
A gray sky. Sorry, and one can have quite interesting experience meditating in fog, etc. But it doesn't have the same quality as this, because you don't have that light coming in. Here you're making use of that light to really bring out the clarity aspect of mind.
I find at the stage I'm at, my mind must seek out entertainment or something, because I get really vivid pictures in the sky with the clouds. That's just the mind trying to put order or something on it.
Well, yes. I mean, the sensory deprivation experiments show that when there's no stimulation of mind, mind manufactures its own stimulation. What we're doing in meditation, and one needs to understand that a lot of what we're doing in meditation is totally against the biological, psychological, and cultural conditioning we've grown up with. It's not natural at all. it's business about natural awareness. It feels that, but it isn't natural at all. I mean, it's very simple. You know, two cavemen are walking along. They hear a sound. One says, "That's interesting," and the other runs as fast as he can. Whose genes survive? So. This is not natural, so there you have, you know, manufacturing all of this stuff to, you know, as you say, entertain, to provide stimulation, and this is where, a few days ago, I talked about bringing that emotional quality, whether it's trust or faith or loving kindness or whatever. That's where it's really important, because one comes up, all that stimulation comes up because you're feeling alone, and there's fear coming up, and so there's automatic stuff just to get something going so that mind can be engaged and you don't have to. That you know, existential terror is kept at bay, basically by distraction. And this is where that emotional quality becomes very, very important, because it gives us the emotional energy, the emotional basis to actually rest in our experience and not automatically generate entertainment and so forth.
Well, it certainly isn't purposeful, so it just needs to unwind, right? Work its way out.
Well, it depends on your point of view. From in terms of our automatic conditioning, it is purposeful. It's not intentional, that is, we aren't doing it, but it is purposeful in that it provides stimulation so that, and you know, and there's a tradition of the Bardo retreat where you're 30 or 90 days in total blackness. There are a few Westerners do it. I mean, a long time in Tibet they just gave up doing it because people just went crazy. Because it is a sensory deprivation process. And the aim of it is to learn how to be present with all the hallucinations that the mind will generate, not the mind, the physiology of our mind-body system will generate automatically. And so how do you be present with that? Then you can be present with anything, but very, very high incidence of insanity. Few Westerners have done it, but it's demanding. Gary?
Yeah, the question I have regards how the physiology is set up for shock when something, you know, very surprising or sort of out of the norm happens. And so hearing you talk about this practice and what you just said about it runs counter to a lot of conditioning, but I'm looking at mainly more the physiology, because I've been finding what you've talked about in terms of what we couldn't experience before because we didn't have the level of energy or attention, and then building the capacity through stable attention, energy practices, etc., to eventually meet that. That makes sense. And then looking at the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva in terms of what you take into your life, I imagine, that's more of a stretch for me in terms of encountering things that do shock and stun us. And I know this is probably not fair to you to mention, but one of the things that always stayed with me was the story I heard about a mother of, I guess these were Boston University students that were in the Lockerbie disaster, and she was a sculptress. So what she did was to remember her first moments when she heard the news, which was collapse or whatever. So she did a sculpture of herself, and then she decided she wanted to see all the news clips, because the news media went to the airport and captured people getting the news. That to me is shock. So I think when we talk about being present with everything that arises, I think it sounds great, but I'm kind of going to the extreme here, because there is something about our physical bodies, and we can kind of say, hey, you know, it's a survival mechanism, et cetera, but I think it's there for a good reason.
Well, it's there for a very good reason, and even, I don't know this for sure, but even when you've trained very deeply, dealing with really very, very fundamental terrors and fears, which one deliberately incites through practices such as chut and so forth. As you say, there is the basic physiology. And when things happen, just because you're very awake and present doesn't mean you don't have emotions. I mean, we have the record of Marpa. Marpa's son was killed in a riding accident. And then Marpa heard the news. And Marpa was a pretty awake guy by all the accounts. He was devastated. He loved his son, Dharmadhodi, very much. Had planned to pass on the transmission to him. And so he was just heartbroken, shattered. Not only had he lost his son, but it shattered all his dreams. And he sobbed. He just cried his heart out. And his wiseacre students, who are probably just like us, said, "You always told us that everything was an illusion. Why are you crying?" And as you read the Marpa's biography, he says, "This is extra illusion." And there's another story from the Zen tradition of a woman who is a very highly regarded teacher. And she lost a child. And when the child was being buried, she was sobbing. And her stupid students. Students tend to be stupid. nobody here included. said, "You've always told us everything is illusion. Why are you crying?" And she just turned and gave them that lovely Zen stare. If you don't understand how every tear I shed saves countless sentient beings, you know nothing about Zen. And then she went back to crying. So, it's not that these emotions and feelings go away. It's quite the opposite. You get to experience them in vivid technicolor. 3D. Happy now?
Well, that raises my next point. There are some people that have very high tolerance to physical and emotional pain.
Yeah.
And others don't.
Yes.
So, when you say that, I've heard you say in the past, it's like having no skin.
That's compassion, yeah.
Okay. So,
I've always wondered why people say, "I want to be more compassionate." I look at them and say, "Are you nuts?" Because it's like having no skin. Everything. Yow! Go on.
So, to keep engaging that, I mean, don't you think after a while you're going to be down to your bones?
Yeah, well, that's what Suzuki Roshi says. And then you get serious. What's the problem here?
I think that's where the crazy part comes in.
Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, there has to be some lightness about compassion. There has to be some sense of humor, some irony.
Oh, you know. There's all that. And yeah. There's also... you also know it is experience. I mean, how to say this? Yes, you have no skin. And you want it to be that way. Because you're in touch with the world. And so within that, you see suffering, and you see the destructiveness of suffering with vivid clarity. And there's also joy and humor and all of those other things. I mean, it's not all, oh, it's world suffering. No. But you aren't fooled by stuff. You try it sometime.
That's where you kind of take the foot and kick the person off the cliff stage, isn't it?
Whenever I have that opportunity, it feels so good.
Try wearing shoes next time.
Pardon?
Try wearing shoes next time.
What, for the person who's jumping off the cliff? It doesn't make any difference. Over here, there's a question. And Michael, did you have something?
You don't want to hear science, do you?
No.
Distress tolerance, no.
Distress tolerance, yeah, well, we could go into all of that, the physiology.
Something that I do research on, and the short answer is that he doesn't...
Just a second. You got it.
It looks like not so much that you become open to more suffering. It's not just that you become more porous, but you actually become capable of experiencing it without withdrawing. So it's really a strength that gets cultivated. And you really don't let it in. You can't let it in until you're able to tolerate it. Like we sort of shut down
automatically.
Voluntarily.
Yeah.
And something the practice does, and this is, you know, for you to say this is a mystery of it, is that it strengthens some capacity to suffer without really becoming reactive in a way that closes that door.
Yeah, and that's... I don't think they've got that one sussed out yet.
Let's not go there.
Yeah, okay. Okay, over here. Over here.
You talk about how this is one way to experience life, not the only way. So if we're in situations, I guess it really follows up on the comments about the science. If we're really in situations where we're not able to tolerate experiencing everything that's going on, can't we either choose, probably not choose, but don't we naturally revert to not experiencing everything so that we can handle it?
Yeah, I think that's what Michael was saying. There's the automatic mechanisms kick in, and they've kicked in all our lives, which is why a lot of stuff gets buried. It's the automatic mechanisms kicked in. There are consequences to that, and later in our lives they cause us increasing amounts of inconvenience. But through these practices, and there's a great range of practices, but they have ways of creating the possibility of experiencing quite difficult experiences without those automatic mechanisms kicking in and without it being actually harmful to the organism, to the system.
But even if we can't experience something, we're at least aware that it's happened, right? And we can return to it in a... You talk about maybe touching things that are too difficult to experience, you know, across the room or something like that?
Yeah, that's a way of increasing capacity. In technical terms, it could be called progressive desensitization, but it doesn't really work that way, at least not in my experience, because there's an awakening quality in it as well.
So if you can't experience something, even... When you practice and you realize that you weren't able to experience it in the moment,
yeah, then
is it locked in you and you really can't get at it? Right
no,
away,
no, not right away. No, but one of the techniques that I give people, and this is a adaptation of the 5-step practice from Thich Nhat Hanh, is when he's teaching it, he talks about opening to 1/10 or 1/100 of the experience. People I've worked with, and for myself, I don't find that very helpful because, you know, you crack that little door open, it's, you know, it's like blast furnace, it's there. So what I experimented with is putting it at a distance. This seems to work fairly well. Some people it's across the room, some people it's, you know, outside, some people it's across the town, some people it has to be on the other side of the country. But what I'm trying to set up there is it's in your awareness at a level which you can experience it, which when it's some distance away is diluted, of course, or it's not as intense. But when you do it that way, I mean, if for instance, I suppose it was a very significant loss, and so you imagine that loss at some distance from you. And because it's, you know, we think metaphorically or experience things metaphorically, that some distance attenuates the intensity. So now you breathe, just doing the 5-step practice as it's outlined here. Breathing in, I experience this loss. Breathing out, I experience this loss. Until you can do that, because the intensity is sufficiently attenuated. And then, breathing in, I experience the physical reactions to this loss, and the emotional reactions, and the stories, etc. And they're also attenuated because it's at some distance. So you can actually go through this whole process. And then, when you hit that relaxing and being at ease with this, then you realize, oh, I can actually bring it a bit closer now. And so progressively over time, you bring it closer and closer until you can experience it completely.
So that's something you would use afterwards, but it's not something, I mean, if you're in the middle of something shocking like Gary was saying.
Oh, if it's happening right now, if something happening, it really depends on your level of attention. People with a high level of attention who are highly trained could be present right in that. And you see this in the case of, some of these emergency workers and first line responders, they're absolutely amazing what they can do. And a lot of that's because of their training. Yeah. Okay. Ralph.
Many of you probably know that I personally had a devastating loss of the magnitude of what I think is the subject tonight. The loss of my wife recently. And so I can speak from first-hand experience of dealing with something that's probably beyond your capacity. And I think it has to be done in stages. And I think if you are able to approach it in the way that Ken's saying, that it takes on a bittersweet quality. There's almost a joy in knowing that you can experience it directly. And once that happens, you're able to work your way out of the wormhole and open up, because the immediate reaction is that's all that exists in your world, and that world will never change. And I think all the things, I came into this retreat trying to decide whether it was worth it and whether there could be any way to judge progress in the retreat. And my answer now would be definitely yes. Because all the techniques that we're learning here and talking about do work in the real world. And sometimes you have to wait for a tragedy to really find out where you're at and how effective they are. And all the effort that you put in, which is sometimes doesn't make any sense, you don't want to do it. But that's all I have to say.
Thanks, Ralph. Okay. Other questions about any other aspects of practice? Helen? We need a runner.
I was kind of hoping that possibly maybe this is a little more limited view of this process, that perhaps it would help increase one's sense of spaciousness and how that helps tremendously in one's own day-to-day situations and perceiving others in a more spacious way. There's a qualitatively different sort of way than we normally would operate.
What you're calling spaciousness comes directly out of being in the experience of whatever you're doing. You don't think, if you think spaciously, it's artificial. But if you're right in the experience of whatever you're doing, then you find there is more physical space and more temporal space. And it comes from the quality of attention. Okay. Larry. And then Paul. We did have two mics. One of them got damaged, and this is just so much simpler than the old. It's not simpler technically, but in terms of being able to carry it around and set it up, it's so much simpler than the old system. Yes.
These are practice questions.
Please.
You have encouraged me to open my heart. And
not just you.
Well, I couldn't speak for other people, so I'll take ownership. And that opening process, I'm sure you've talked about this before, but I'm also sure you can put it in new words. Fresh words. As you open.
Hope springs eternal in the youth.
With youth.
Keep going, Larry.
What I'm trying to understand is, as one works with this opening, you can't say, I only want raspberry feelings surfacing. You're going to get whatever fruit or vegetable comes up. And, you know, you can go into wanting to investigate one thing, and all of a sudden you're investigating something quite different. With that, a lot of affect comes up, and a lot of energy comes up, even when you try to be aware. And within formal meditation practice, I found that getting off the cushion, I can be kind of growly. And
this sounds like a good sign.
Yeah, well, my wife is growly too when she gets off the cushion. I mean, not all the time, but this happens.
Okay.
And we know enough to give each other space.
Good.
But sometimes you have to go out in the world and you're still feeling pretty growly about this. So I'm trying to understand any thoughts you would have and how you manage all of these flavors of affect that come to the fore. When we're out there trying to function in the world and control what comes out of our mouth.
Oh, you're asking the wrong person. Having spent 2 weeks daily screaming at AT&T. Well, you're quite right. When you open emotionally, you don't get to choose what's there. I know, I was teaching a Mahamudra class a few years ago. And it seemed to be going fine. And then this guy asked this question. He's a screenwriter in Hollywood. So, when you become more aware, can you choose what you're aware of? And I said, no. And he really didn't like that. And that's when you become more aware, you're more aware of everything. And when you open emotionally, then it's all there. Now, I love the way you put it. If you're a bit growly whenever you get up for meditation, it does suggest something. That there's a certain amount of suppressed anger.
Or whatever.
No, well, anger.
Growly covered a wide spectrum of grumpy.
No, I pay attention
emotions.
To grumpy emotions.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I'm fine. The grumpy anger, whatever. Do you want to throw Sleepy and Doc in there too? Bashful. No. So, what do you call it? Anger. Grumpiness, growly, irritable, slow burn, volcanic river, volcanic or rivers of volcanic lava seething below the surface. I don't care. It's all the same stuff. It's all in that camp, yes. Okay. When was the last time you opened your heart to that?
Well, I was going to go home and do it right away.
You got to say that.
I said I was going to go home and do it right away.
I have a question for you, Larry.
Yeah.
Why wait?
Well, I have to. That volcanic lava has to come to the fore in a real.
Why wait? Way. Why not do it now?
You want me to get angry?
It's not what I said.
Well, then how can I?
I said, open your heart to the anger.
But it's not there right now. I mean, that I can see. I'm sure you could make me see it.
What was that, Gary?
Where's Martha?
Where's the horse Martha when you need him, right?
Would AT&T help?
But I don't know. You have to ask Larry, would AT&T help?
I understand. You don't have to say anything.
Can you feel it in you?
When it arises?
No, can you feel it in you right now? It may not be particularly active, but if you're growly after meditation on a regular basis, then it's fairly likely that you can touch something there that's in that area pretty well any time.
But I didn't say it was on a regular basis.
That was the impression I had.
No, it just happens once in a while.
Okay, well, anyway, can you feel it now? People are moving away from you slowly. Please remove all sharp objects.
I really can't feel it in the way that I know anger.
That's not what I'm asking. Can you feel, let me put it this way. Can you feel anything that is in the aversion quadrant of emotions? Actually, it's the, what do you call it, three?
Yeah, I can certainly feel aversion right now.
Now, are you willing to play with this a little bit?
You mean later or
right with me right now?
If it'll serve a purpose.
Forget about it serving a purpose. You know, are you willing?
Sure. Okay.
Okay. So you can touch something in the aversion quadrant?
Yes.
Okay. What happens when you open your heart to that?
Well, there's a softening process that begins.
Okay. That's how you practice. You know, somebody mentioned the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva earlier this evening. That's about, you know, how you relate to the world. It's one way of interpreting the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. Another is to read it mythically. It's how you work with all your internal material. So, just to take a juicy line here. Now, let me know if any of you have ever experienced anything like this in your meditation practice. When you are down and out, held in contempt, desperately ill, and emotionally crazy. Okay? Anything like this. Even if a person you have cared for as your own child treats you as his or her worst enemy. Okay. So this is another way of working with it. And many of you may know the Dhammapada collection of verses, which has been translated into English innumerable times. Actually wasn't translated into Tibetan until 1929, I think. Yeah, it was Gyendun Chöpö found the text and realized, oh, we don't have this one, translated it into Tibetan. He's an interesting guy, Gyendun Chöpö. But one of the most famous verses in the Dhammapada is, hatred never overcomes hatred. Hatred is only overcome by love. And one usually thinks of this as through interaction, but it applies just as much to internal processes. If you hate a part of yourself, and let's face it, a lot of us do, that's a wall from which you will you put up between you and this part of yourself, and it will experience being alienated. You will experience being alienated from that, and it can go on for a very, very long time. And there may be very good reasons. It may be too painful. It may be too horrific. And one of the ways that I've suggested people work with taking and sending, and this is an internal method, you don't find, at least I haven't found this anywhere stated explicitly in classical literature, and several of you have been working with us in the course of this retreat, but one way that I view taking and sending is a way to start forming a connection with any part of your experience from which you are deeply alienated. So if there's an aspect of yourself that you don't want to have anything to do with, or is too painful to touch, or whatever, then you do taking and sending. Because we actually know what it feels like behind the wall. Or we have a good idea. So it's easy to do the taking. And sending means that we have to connect with our own good feeling and extend that to this part that's alienated. And it starts building a bridge. Now, emotionally, that can be pretty interesting. Not always a walk in the park, by any means. But can be very, very helpful in forming relationships with these parts, which we then take the next step and then start to include in awareness. Okay. Charles, and then Eric. Where's the mic? Okay, Paul, you were right. Yes, Paul first. Thank you.
About the sky gazing?
Yes?
I never tried it. But according to my notes here, it says...
Can't trust what you write.
I stare into the sky and I forget anything I'm thinking about. And then I'm supposed to remember to... bring active attention to everything, and that becomes the internal sky, and then something happens, and then Grinpa.
And then you're enlightened. the last part was great, Paul, but there are a few stumbling blocks at the beginning. You stare into the sky, and it's an active gaze. It's not a.
Yeah, I got that.
Okay. You don't say, oh, just forget everything. The ordinary thinking process crumbles.
Yeah.
It's good that you raise this, because it's really important to distinguish between method and effects and results of practice. Because time and time again, people will take effects and results of practice as the method, and they really mess themselves up. Because it doesn't work. I mean, the trivial example, which we all know, is, why don't you just relax? And everybody tenses up when they hear that. Whereas if you say, take a deep breath, let it out slowly, do it again, do it once more, then a person relaxes. And so, 'cause it relaxes the result of a method. So the method is that active gaze. And one of the results is the thinking process crumbles. It doesn't crumble immediately, but over time. So you don't forget everything. The thinking process crumbles. That's part of the process of the practice. It happens. The method is looking into the sky.
Yeah. I think I'm just confused about between part two and three. What happens? What are we supposed to do?
Nothing. Just keep,
happens.
Yeah. Just as you find yourself, you look into the external sky, as the thinking process crumbles, you find yourself resting in what I've called alaya vijnana, you know, in this eighth consciousness, which is the basis of everything consciousness. It's very, very still state of mind. And then you find yourself looking into that. And then the same process happens, is that the dualistic patterning crumbles. That's when Rigpa is present. But all you're doing is continuing the looking.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks.
Right.
Can I add to that? The resting quality is very important in this practice.
See.
The resting quality is very important in this practice. So as an instruction, as you're looking at the sky, really allow yourself to deeply move into a state of rest, because that tends to cut any sort of I'm trying to make this happen or all that. You need to let all that go.
Yeah, good point. Eric, then Charles.
I think instead of just using the retreat to explore non-conceptual awareness, conceptual mind has been churning on something.
You'll have to leave.
I think it was your opening comments on the retreat. You talked about a change in world religions moving towards...
Oh, put the blame on me. Thank you very much.
Moving towards embracing the human condition rather than transcending.
Yes.
And I brought that up because it seems to me that much of what you've taught, and that's touched me very deeply in this retreat, has sprung from that, in that you've been teaching practices about embracing and ending the struggle now, and that there is no future enlightenment, and so forth. And what I've been struggling with is, does it matter? Is that possible if you believe in reincarnation? Is embracing the human condition rather than transcending it, and practicing from that view of the goal, possible if one believes, say, some of the traditional Buddhist view, in which this life is a burning house, or alternatively, we may be sitting here in a comfortable place in New Mexico, but we're about to be exposed to inconceivable torture for countless eons.
Well, I think it just adds a further challenge, doesn't it? I mean, you're going to have a much deeper practice than me, because you've got much more extreme conditions to embrace. So I don't see any problem. You're just going to go further. You know? I mean, if that's how you look at the world, then you shouldn't think anything of sitting out in the sun all day. It's just a little warm-up. No. What do you have to say? I mean, if you're going to take that point of view, take that point of view and really do it. Okay? And if that's a possibility in your worldview, okay. Then you've got a lot of practice to do, because you're going to have to be in that experience and be present in it. It's the only way you're going to be in that experience and not suffer is by being totally in it.
I'm not sure I want to go any further than that.
Do you get my point?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, Charles.
Actually, I wanted to hear the answer to Sonia's question about the refuge formula in the beginning practice and its relation to sky gazing.
I hand it back to Sonia so she can pose the question. And you're right. I needed to come back to her.
And so my question was the experience of sky gazing, and to a certain extent taking and sending, has, it reminds me of the lines in the refuge. So nothing outside or inside to free me, experience and awareness are not two, and nothing to grasp or oppose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the lines remind me of a quality, and I'm not able to make the connection to how that's related to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
Ah, now I understand your question. Well,
it's like experience and awareness are not two, right? There's this sense of no separation, but there's more. The quality of that is that it's something I know. It's not unknown. But I don't see how that relates to
Dharma. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Well, why don't we start with you telling me what Buddha and Dharma and Sangha are?
They're, well, they're not the literal meaning.
That isn't telling me what they are. That's telling me what they are not.
They're not.
What is Buddha? Straightforward question there.
It's a place that knows, but it permeates everything.
What is it?
It's not a thing. It's a quality. That's why these things keep coming up as qualities for me.
What's the quality of Buddha?
It's everywhere and nowhere. It's
I'm sorry, I'm having a really difficult time understanding this.
It's like the sky. Buddha. I can only use it in metaphors.
Buddha, sky. Okay, yeah. You got to help me here.
It's what's not overlaid with anything.
It's what's not overlaid with anything.
It's when there's no
reactions, no compensation, no, it's just what is.
Read the first line of the Refuge.
There's nothing outside or inside to free me. It's my experience.
Makes sense now?
Makes sense now.
Okay. So what's the Dharma?
It's that quality that knows. It knows.
So read the...
No separation makes sense.
Okay. You're okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. 2 out of 3. Let's go for a... What's Sangha?
Oh, nothing to grasp or oppose. I'm working through that one. The way I feel nothing to grasp or oppose is when there's nothing to fight.
Yeah.
There's yeah. And you release that and you're a bit more aware of something or you relate to things differently.
You're right, exactly.
Yeah.
And Sangha is about relationship. Relating to things without grasping or opposing.
But that's the quality of compassion too, right?
Yes, very definitely. Yeah. In Wake Up to Your Life, page 46, those in one page reference. Mind is originally empty, clear, unrestricted experience. It says unimpeded here because I didn't have the word unrestricted when I wrote this. To take refuge in Buddha is to rest in the emptiness of original mind, free from any reference or defining characteristic. Okay? It's the emptiness aspect. Take refuge in Dharma is to experience the clarity of original mind. Natural awareness knows what experience, how it arises. Experience and awareness. To take refuge in Sangha is to be one with the unrestricted arising and subsiding experience, free from attraction, aversion, and indifference. Makes sense now?
Makes a lot of sense.
Good. Always works better if you work for it, you know. Okay. Anybody else? Nobody's going to ask any questions now. Too much work.
Just a technical question. Is it possible to do stargazing inside looking out a window?
Yes, okay. Probably. If it's a
you
nice
don't have to be in direct
connection.
With
well, you can try it. Yeah. Huh? I mean, it's so much better when there's just like all those stars. But you try it and see. Yeah. Okay. See, we're 8:15. Oh, please.
Just a simple clarification question. In the Vajra song, recognizing mind as guru.
Yep.
On page 25, here's how I know it is fulfilling. Emptiness is just there. I don't need to hunt for the dimension of truth. Whatever appears just arises. I don't need to block the dimension of form. Mind itself is free as it is. I don't need to control the three dimensions of being. I got confused there. I understand truth is one dimension. Form is another dimension. I wasn't sure what you meant by the third dimension.
The technical terms here are Dhammakaya, Nirmanakaya, and Trikaya. they're translated in various ways. Very, very difficult terms to translate. there are various theories as to the origin of the three forms or the three dimensions. But my favorite one is, it starts with a line, uh, I know it's in the it's in the Diamond Sutra. I also think it's in the Lankavatara Sutra. But I think it's in actually in some of the Pali Sutras too. Buddha must have had a very difficult time. Because the Indians are irritatingly literal at the same time as being extraordinarily good philosophers. And so they, like many things, they would attach to, you know, the physical presence of the Buddha. And this reduced Buddha to saying at one point, "He who sees my form does not see me." Which, of course, threw his students into massive confusion. And like, but, okay. And so they said, okay, if the physical form of the Buddha is not the Buddha, then there must be a true form of the Buddha. And that was termed the Dharmakaya, which is the true form. And the physical form was called Rupakaya, which means the form, literally, or physical form. But that, when people really started going to their experience, they realized that there was a third way that the Buddha, or there was a third experience, that is, when you're in the presence of Buddha, things just felt extraordinarily open. That was the true form, or Dharmakaya. And then you were in the physical presence, you could actually see this person walking and talking and eating and so forth. But then there was emotional / energetic experience where, you know, you're just like, oh. And this became termed the Sambhogakaya, or enrichment form. Again, very difficult term to translate. So this matured into a whole way of describing how awakening manifests in experience, as known as the three kayas, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. And when Vajrayana evolved, it just provided a wonderful vehicle for discussing all kinds of things. It became a paradigm which was a fantastic shortcut to point to all kinds of aspects of experience with just these very, very few words. And of course developed into massive philosophies on the nature of each of these forms of expressions of awakening and their interrelationships and so forth, and just goes on and on and on, both in the Indian and the Tibetan traditions. But you know, whenever I asked Kala Rinpoche about this, or and I also had the same kind of conversation with Nisha Kempo and other teachers, when you read the sutras, you think these are these fantastic things which, you know, only the most astute and highly realized people can possibly even get glimpses of. That's all part of the mythologization of awakened experience, but they're really very simple. And Kongtrul in 7 Points of Mind Training basically does the same kind of explanation. So take any experience. And you take an emotional experience, you can take a experience of a flower, or, you know, sunset, or the view over the prairies, sound, it doesn't matter. Take any experience. It can be a sensory experience or emotional experience. Now, what's important here is to focus on the experience, not the object of the experience. Okay? This is in keeping with the fact that everything we're talking about is from an experiential point of view, not from a does it exist, does it not exist point of view. So take any experience, and you know, Larry, you can take anger. As it can be sensory experience or emotional, and let it become very vivid for you. So it's a vivid experience, you know, and it can be, you can look at this light, for instance, that's fine. So the experience of seeing light or seeing red cushions. Okay, that vividness of experience is the form aspect of experience. Okay? Now, come back to the experience. And ask yourself, what is this experience? And you've been with me, I think, when I've done this before, Christy, but just in case you haven't, I'll put you through it. What do you see?
For the purpose of the podcast, I will say. For the purpose of the podcast, he's holding up a white napkin.
Okay. Now I have a very simple question for you. Where is the experience of seeing?
Nowhere.
How can you say that? You're seeing this white napkin. It can't be nowhere, otherwise you couldn't see it. Should I make it easier for you? Okay, is it inside you or outside you?
Neither.
Neither. Then where is it? No fair throwing microphones. Okay, what are you experiencing right now? When you look at your experience and you say, where is it? What do you experience right there?
Empty.
Okay. True form. That's Dharmakaya. Okay. That's Dharmakaya. It's the empty quality of experience. That experience arises very vividly. That's the Nirmanakaya aspect. But when you look at it, as you said, it's nowhere. That's the Dharmakaya aspect. Okay? Now, vivid experience of white napkin? Please say yes. Okay. Look at where the experience is, which we just went through. Like, okay. Now, both of those together, the seeing and the experience being nowhere at the same time, experience both of those. What happens? Is there a bit of a shift?
yes, but it's going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Okay. So just open to both of them at the same time. And don't try to understand this rationally, because you can't. Doesn't work. Just open to both those aspects of experience at the same time. What do you experience? That's not bad, but just put that into words.
It's just calm.
Yeah. But there's a shift in the actual experience of the napkin, right? Okay, that's Sambhogakaya.
The labeling stopped.
The labeling stops.
The visual experience, the conceptualization of the experience stopped.
Yeah. But the experience itself had a quotation marks, richer quality. Yeah. That's why it's called the enrichment body.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, just to complete the picture, you don't have to worry about this. I'll just give this to everybody. there's the fourth kaya, in which all three of those are experienced simultaneously. It's called the svabhavika kaya, or essence thing. It's just, you know, and then you get into the five kayas, and I think there's even six kayas somewhere. But we don't have to worry about that. The idea is that these three kayas, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, originally rose from people trying to understand their experience of Buddha. But I don't know how quickly, over the course of a couple of centuries probably, generalized to, this is how experience arises. And in all kinds of theories and everything were developed around them, but in terms of working with experience, there's the empty aspect of experience, the vivid aspect of experience, and what happens when we experience the vividness and the emptiness together. When we experience the world that way, that's a good step in the direction of being awake. So, going back to your original question, Christy, emptiness is just there. I don't need to go looking for it. I don't need to look for the Dharmakaya. You follow? Whatever appears just arises. I don't have to block appearance in order to move into this totality of experience. I don't have to, you know, move into formless states or anything like that. Mind itself is free as it is. That is, experience is just experience. So I don't need to control these or manipulate or do something with all of this. I mean, it's fairly helpful quite frequently to substitute the word experience for mind. And it's not inaccurate. Basically, experience is one way to read the fourth line there. It's experience is free as it is. I don't need to control experience. Does this help?
Probably.
probably don't want to go this way, but part of me still keeps trying to think of the other Trinity that a lot of people are familiar with, and God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost. In terms of metaphor, is there a, would those be similar metaphors?
Well, my personal opinion, the three persons of God, I think, potentially, is very closely related to the three forms of Buddha, and that the term Kaya was translated by the term, the word person, and gave rise to a whole bunch of problems. Now, I don't have any scholastic basis for that. I think there's been some speculation about it, but I don't know anybody who's established, do you know? No. Any correspondences. But the they're contemporaneous, we know that. But one of the problems with the translating it as person, which is a reasonably valid translation for Kaya, because it's the honorific for person in Sanskrit. You know, you refer to them in Tibetan, for instance, the word is ku. So, you know, you come into the presence of the form, is how you say you meet a lama. When we consider when they're considered as persons, that entrains a whole nother metaphor. The term in Sanskrit means form, it's honorific form, and is translated in Tibetan by the honorific for form. It wasn't translated into anything else. I have no idea how it was translated into Chinese. Because it hasn't been personalized by use of the word person, then it's available to become a metaphor and a paradigm for all aspects of experience. And that's how it functions today, and has for centuries, in Tibetan Buddhism anyway. But yes, we think of, you know, the Trikaya, the three persons of God, and it seems out there. And much of practice is to realize that your mind is the nature of the three kayas, which is to say, experience arises that way. Helen?
I'd like to go back to Dharmakaya. It seemed as if when you were asking where is your experience of the napkin, that it seemed very conceptual, and wasn't the whole point that it's non-conceptual? Emptiness is non-conceptual?
Do you see this napkin?
Yes, I do.
Where is the seeing?
Well, I feel it's in myself.
Where's that?
In my mind.
Where's that?
In my experience.
Where's that?
Does it matter where it is? If it just is. It just happens.
Oh, it just happens. Now, you have just dropped a concept.
Oh. Well, I still don't see...
Not for long.
I don't see why it's necessary to ask where or location is. If an experience is a direct experience,
it was a way of moving you into direct experience, and miracle of miracles, it actually worked for a few seconds. But as Michael so eloquently said, but not for long. But everything stopped for a little bit, right? Yeah, good. That was the point. Because everything you were saying before, well, you know, well, it's in me. Well, where's that? Well, that's in myself. Well, where's that? Well, that's in my experience. Well, that's all concept. And then you ran out. And for a few moments, you experience things without concept. That's your practice. Okay? Very good. Okay. You guys had enough? Let's take a break here, and we'll come back for meditation in a few minutes.
Hi, Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating, because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path 2, Part 13.